And we're continuing today with our series with the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'd like today to welcome Shannon Kennedy. She is a civil rights attorney representing the families of people killed by the Albuquerque police. Adrienne Barboa is from Strong Families and APD Forward Steering Committee. And Emily Kaltenbach, who is with the Drug Policy Alliance. She's working with LEAD, which stands for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, here in Santa Fe. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
So this is the program in which we talk about a subject that is on so many people's minds, which is basically what is going on with police in America who shoot children carrying toy guns, who shoot and kill mentally ill people. They kill a guy who's selling cigarettes. They kill people running from traffic stops. Help us to understand what's going on, because this doesn't happen, for example, in European countries, which are also industrial societies that have police forces. What's going on?
From a perspective of what's wrong in America as opposed to internationally, you look at a glorification of violence within American culture, and you look at young men who've been sent to war in Iraq and Afghanistan and come back, and they have a role in society, and the local police departments have hired them, or young men who apply, and there are some women who apply as well. But the training that they're receiving is very much there's a war on terror in America, and we're fighting terrorists. And they really are going to war against citizens in America. And some of those citizens are children of color, also young teenage boys who have BB guns, regardless of what their ethnicity may be, and then the mentally ill. And I represent the family of James Matthew Boyd and the highly viral video that changed everything in the city of Albuquerque, because for the first time we could see the lies that officers had taken a human life, stand over someone suffering and dying, and they're so disconnected from their own humanity that they handcuff a man begging for help. And so it's really a reflection of the coarsening of culture in America. And it's a reflection of a history of violence in America against certain people in our community, and a real failure of our community to provide adequate mental health care to those suffering mental illness and homelessness.
There's so many things to talk about in what you just said. One of them is the reality of violence that extends back centuries in America. I mean, we come from a slave-owning tradition, and slavery was not just about the southern United States. Slaves, we had them in the north, and the slave trade made many northerners rich. And that deep kind of racism and that deep acceptance of violence against particularly African Americans is so ingrained in parts of the national identity of this country.
Yes, and the sort of invisibility of it. I go back to the invisible man. And when I've represented African Americans who've suffered police abuse for driving while black, and it starts with the traffic stop that should never happen, because officers are trained that African Americans are more likely than not to be committing crimes, and that arises from the war on drugs, but they don't realize that the traffic stop escalates into violence. And it's completely divorced from the constitutionality of our country. I mean, we have this horrific history of slavery and violence, but then we have these political ideals that are the best in the country. So really the answer is community constitutional policing and training people not to criminalize, you know, every wrong turn that someone takes while driving, or not to criminalize, you know, what's happening in our public schools with children. So
Are you saying that when you say they're trained that black people are more likely to be criminals, this is actually part of their official training as police?
I believe so. And not maybe in the academy, but certainly in the fields. Certainly in the fields. Because why else would it be happening? Why else would we have such a disproportionate number of African Americans in prisons today? It's not that African Americans are more violent, right? I mean, that's the racist stereotype. It's that police are trained to stop people driving while black and to criminalize them, and it creates a an us versus them culture and a culture of violence and aggression towards certain communities. And those communities become disenfranchised and they don't get into the courts. And that's why you end up with riots in the streets, because they've been cut out of the institutions that are supposed to make everyone equal in this country.
How does the addition of black police men and women, mostly men, mitigate, if it does, violence against black civilians?
Well, I've represented African American and female police officers that have been terribly discriminated against within their own departments. So there's that. But if they're not being discriminated within their own departments and become part of the brotherhood, I'll call it a brotherhood because it really is a male-dominated culture, then they too cannot burn blue. So they're not African American or Hispanic or female, they're blue. And you don't burn blue, and that's the culture. And so oftentimes you see African American officers who are as violent, if not more violent, towards own members of their community.
What do you mean by burn blue? What does that mean?
It means the blue code of silence. If you see a police officer unlawfully frisk a young African American male, you do not report that to the chain of command. Right? You don't report, because if you do, then you've burned blue. You don't have your brother's back. And the culture is, in the field, we are one another's brothers and sisters. And if you betray one of us like that, report us for misconduct, then we can't trust you. And then who's going to show up for backup when you need someone? So that's what causes, I mean, it's really striking how few whistleblowers you see within police departments, because the price of blowing the whistle is someone could not have your back in a very dangerous situation.
It's really like snitch culture within jails or criminal gangs. I mean, if somebody's a snitch, they are ostracized.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the mental health piece. When you say there's not the training about dealing in a sensitive way with people with mental health problems, and also there's not the support for people with mental health issues.
Yes, and again, it goes to decriminalizing being mentally ill. I mean, because we have a lack of social resources, I mean, with Obamacare, more and more people suffering from mental disabilities are finally getting access to health care. But for the last, since Reagan, since the last 25 years in this country, we see more and more people on the streets, and who's on the streets responding to these crises? Police officers. And they're not mental health care professionals. And they're treating the mentally ill, and they're criminalizing what happens on the streets with people suffering from mental illness. But then there's the fact that where can people get health care in this country? In the jails and prisons, right? So the officers are told, well, this person is suffering a psychotic episode. I need to take this person to jail because that's how I can get them into the system, rather than to UNMH or to some place where they can get adequate medical care if they're not, so the officers aren't, I mean, they're really being asked to act as frontline healthcare providers.
That's crazy.
Yes. Paradoxically, it's crazy with crazy.
Yeah. Let's talk about the military piece of it. They're returning veterans who then get jobs on local police forces or state police forces. What is the difference, at least theoretically, between being a soldier and being a police person?
Well, having had the privilege of representing people who've served our country, and they hear the term militarization of the police, they're insulted because, and having represented Marines who are so expertly trained, and there is a chain of command, and if you mess up in the military, there isn't this snitch culture, right? So you take people who've been in the military and you put them in a police department. They have, some of them, the skills to use the AR-15s and the skills to act as soldiers in a police uniform, but there's no chain of command. So you have people given these tools of war, and they're not trained like they are in the military as to how to use them. So, for instance, in the foothills with James Matthew Boyd, you see men, some of whom, like Perez, who is now facing second-degree murder charges, who've been trained as soldiers, and they don't know how to be deployed to a scene with a man who's illegally camping. So, and the people in the police force don't know how to dispatch that. So you should have command and control and cover, and time is on your side. And instead, they arrive on the scene and close distance with an array of tools, lethal and less than lethal, and create chaos because they're not properly trained. So it's the worst of these two worlds. You have the militarization because you have the gear, you have the tools, but you don't have the training like you do in the military.
Well, and it's really different training. I mean, one of the things that I always feel uncomfortable about is when people are talking in war situations, not how many lives were lost, but how many American lives were lost. So there's a greater value put on American lives, and some people really believe in that, and some people don't. I don't. I think a life is a life, whatever nationality it might be. But when everybody is in this country, but you're in your mind, you're still making that distinction between the greater value of your people than the so-called enemy, but the enemy are Albuquerqueans. You've got a problem.
Well, when, you know, Keith Sandy arrived on the scene 2 hours and with a taser shotgun that had been discontinued and said, I'm going to shoot this effing lunatic, in the debate whether he used the word penis or pecker or what he said, it's the dehumanization of people suffering, right? Effing lunatic. I'm going to do violence to this person. So you do have the same dynamic that you have in war, which is the enemy is dehumanized. And it's that culture of violence within APD that the Department of Justice exposed. So, for instance, the stopping officer in a case, the Ellis case, with a 25-year-old man with a gun to his own head in front of a 7-Eleven, the officer who made that stop in a very aggressive manner, did a vehicle blocking maneuver in front of a 7-Eleven, had posted on his Facebook page after shooting another person, "My job is human waste disposal." Now, that was his social media post. He was disciplined for that, you know, a slap on the wrist. But that is the cultural underpinnings of the disproportionate number of shootings we have in our country.
The hugeness of that kind of arrogance and that kind of utter lack of empathy and the poor training or complete lack of training that represents. I mean, when we were talking earlier in this series about prison guards get virtually no training. They watch a half an hour video, whereas in, I think it was Germany, prison guards have 2 years of training and they're properly paid professionals who can actually make a living doing what they're doing. When you hear what's going on, I mean, and it's not just the Albuquerque police, but we're talking today about the Albuquerque police. The difference between military training and police training, I mean, it's a different job. And so what should the training be like that they're not getting?
Well, the training that we were demanding that they didn't provide officers before the Boyd shooting is called CIT training. And it's basically skills in communication. It's the capacity to listen. And it's to de-escalate people in crisis. And it's simply that. The problem with police officers, and we have so much audio from the lapel cameras in the shooting, is that they're barking orders at a man who clearly is in the midst of delusion. And the ironic paradox is he had the delusion that the government was going to kill him, and then they did. So it's just the inability to communicate in a loving manner. And so that needs to be the underlying ethos to protect and serve. And instead, the training is incredibly fear-based. It is, you could be killed at any time. You need to go home to your family. There's a war of terrorism out there. And it's sort of like this sort of approach to life that you're always afraid. And so they take these young, impressionable people and tell them and put them on fight or flight mode when they're out there, instead of giving them sense of we truly do operate within a community, and that's what community policing is about. And if you're out there talking to people, they will take care of you. You know, we don't have to vilify the community we're supposed to be protecting and serving. In fact, let's go out and communicate with other people, not just one another. And it's kind of saying, you know, this sort of locker room bravado, it's sort of saying grow up. Like, for instance, the rope unit. Keith Sandy, who said, I'm going to shoot this effing lunatic, ha, ha, ha. They had a safety word within that unit. It was China. So when they started being too rough on one another and saying things that were too emasculating and cruel, they had a safety word. So you've got to take this sort of sadomasochistic culture and say, no, that's adolescent.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to serve the community, grow up and learn how to communicate, be an adult.
Yeah.
And so that is what the training needs to be, is that if you are going to take on the responsibility of wearing a uniform is for adults, not for little boys that want to play with their toys and pretend like they're on some kind of professional sports team. You know, they're here to serve the community. And just like any adults, you need to learn to talk to other adults to solve problems.
And it really is, as you said in the beginning, a cultural problem, because we could see the United States in many ways as an adolescent nation whose adolescent culture is reflected in our media and our movies and so on.
Exactly. It's like Hangover 2, really? You know, having people in their 40s and 50s acting like they're in their 20s? It is a cultural problem, and it's time for America to grow up.
We're talking to Shannon Kennedy, civil rights attorney. Now, there's another problem with ex-soldiers becoming police, besides the lack of training and besides this, you know, bravado and excessive silence about wrongdoing, and that is post-traumatic stress. When you have police with post-traumatic stress out in the field, they're hypervigilant, they're themselves traumatized, that also leads to problems.
Certainly it does. Certainly suffering from PTSD and being in a situation that triggers a response would be terrifying for someone who's served their country. There are people who serve their country with PTSD diagnoses who are completely fit to serve their community. I mean, from the psychological perspective, there are two kinds of people who sign up for service, and many of those people who sign up to serve their country are our heroes. And so I don't want to say just because someone has suffered in war that disqualifies them from coming back and serving in a police department. Because I have known people suffering from PTSD or who have that diagnosis who are fit to protect and serve their community and wear a uniform. On the other hand, if they too are not getting the medical care they need through the Veterans Association, they then are also being victimized and discriminated against. So we need to take care of our veterans, and we need to care for them in a way and find jobs for them within our police departments, but just make sure that they're getting adequate medical care.
Adequate medical care, adequate training, and there's also questions of oversight and accountability, which I know is something that has been called for in Albuquerque.
Well, certainly the Department of Justice has come in, and now Dr. Ginger, who is in charge of running the oversight of the overhaul of APD, the city's going to be spending $4 to $6 million a year for the foreseeable future to fix and address the problems that have existed. So I really believe that the city of Albuquerque can be a model for the rest of the country. I mean, we're seeing for the first time a preliminary hearing charging two officers with murder. That is cutting edge. So I do believe that our community, the state of New Mexico, can create an example for the rest of the country for how to start to address the problems that we're facing as a nation.
When you use the number $4 to $6 million a year, which sounds like a lot, but that's equal to or less than the kind of money that gets paid out in lawsuit settlements for police misconduct in the first place.
Absolutely, and it's an investment well made, because our communities need to be safer. And if officers and the city of Albuquerque can work within the community, it's just going to be good for business. It's going to be good for our state to spend that kind of money and invest in adequate health care for officers and invest in interacting with the most vulnerable people within our community, basically facing the homeless reality we face in the city of Albuquerque. It is exciting, actually.
How do you change the culture of silence, the culture of always protecting each other no matter what and no matter how bad the misconduct?
You create an internal affairs division that's accountable. You create safe places for people to talk openly and honestly about what they're seeing in the field. You create a new officer training program in the field that models community policing.
Has that worked in other places? I mean, it's one thing to train new people, but then turning around an existing culture, Does that work?
Well, that's the work of the Department of Justice for really that's been doing for the last 5 years. After Katrina, in New Orleans, in Portland, Oregon, in Seattle, in Detroit, we have examples of the DOJ coming into communities and trying to make these changes, and in part failing, and in part succeeding. So again, in the city of Albuquerque, we're trying to learn from our mistakes. And I think that the missing link is actually getting out into the field with officers and proactively demonstrating how you de-escalate situations with people. Also decriminalizing, like officers in the public schools, the public school to prison pipeline, teaching SROs, no, we don't need to criminalize the class clown.
SRO?
Student resource officers.
Yeah, exactly. Because otherwise you have, I mean, there are so many ironies that we talk about, and one of them is people who have been trained in the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, who end up actually terrorizing people. Because when you have, for example, SWAT teams sent in to execute a search warrant, when SWAT teams are most appropriate for like hostage situations and really, really serious situations, which we don't have a lot of, but we have these SWAT teams that are sitting there waiting to go, and people are getting killed, and even people who aren't getting killed by the SWAT teams are getting absolutely terrorized by them. And so we have a situation where we come to fear the police. I mean, I have to say, many of us, including me, fear the police at least as much as we fear criminals.
Well, it's the whole notion that we're going to war against ourselves. And why is that happening? And in the sense of execution of warrants, I mean, that is fundamental to our Constitution, that we have privacy and safety within our home. I know many people are afraid to call for help, to call 911 if they have a family member in a mental health crisis because of all the shootings and killings of people suffering from mental disabilities. So it really is sad that we are afraid to call for help because of the response. The constitutional law term would be excessive deployment, that SWAT should not be called out to a situation, to a community caretaker situation in a home. So that has to be addressed in the training that APD officers are going to receive as a result of the DOJ coming to town.
So the DOJ, the Department of Justice, coming to town was a very big deal. They wrote a report. The report basically said, you guys have some very serious problems and need to make some very serious changes. And some of the changes are actually starting to happen now. Adrian Barboa, you are with a group called APD Forward. What's that about?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, I work. I am a field director for Strong Families New Mexico, and we are one of several organizations that are part of the APD Forward campaign and coalition. We have a broad array of organizations and some family members that are really trying to carve out how are we holding reform and implementation of reform, holding all our officials accountable to that, and making sure the public's informed along the process so that there's not a misconstrue of what's happening. For example, like you talked about the money, we want to make sure that our community does know that this is a good investment and that it's not switched to this like wasteful taxpayer dollars, but that actually this is a good investment that is good for Albuquerque. That's an example of the kind of way we want to both be a reliable source of information on reform and really monitor the implementation of reform to make sure it's fitting what our city needs.
So some of the reforms are really very kind of like structural reforms. What do they look like?
Well, the consent decree that has now finally been signed is court ordered. There's very specific, a whole eight categories. There's a whole huge report, and it's very specific about how the city of Albuquerque, how the police department needs to respond to actually make, and that's why what part of the pieces has been hiring the court-ordered monitor, which is now in place. We're excited to actually have met several times with Dr. Ginger, who will be the monitor here in Albuquerque. Part of the piece that we're excited about is that he comes with lots of experience and that he's both ready to take the step to let to have measures and evaluations in place that will help the police department make that culture shift. He, one of the first things he said was that the culture shift is the hardest part. That he can, you know, they can see implementation, they can measure certain things, but the culture shift, and he's very aware of that, which makes us happy that he's the monitor and that he will be the person working on this.
Is there a way in this whole process, is there a part of it where police officers are talking openly with non-police? I mean, getting to know each other, listening to each other, listening to their concerns, stuff like that?
So right now we have APD Forward and Strong Families is moving a very surface level kind of survey out into community members, really just to capture on the surface what have Albuquerqueans' interactions been with police. And, you know, positive, negative, and then some opinions about police. And the reason why we're doing that is to start capturing data broadly about how people are interacting with the police, also what their opinions are, right? But then what we hope to come out, so what we're planning to do with that data is that on September 23rd, we'll be having our first set of a series of town halls on APD, and that will include hopefully officers. We've invited officers. And we'll have community members talking specifically to each other, being able to interact. So we know that that's important. We think it is critical that we know that it's critical that people are involved in this process of reform. One thing that's interesting, right, is that the mayor in the city of Albuquerque, before sort of all of this has gotten, they started trying to jump ahead of the system. And you may, if you live in Albuquerque, you may have seen billboards say talk with the cop, or the mayor created these city councils in the different areas of Albuquerque, and those were supposed to serve as a way in which both police officers and community members were talking to each other. We just heard from a woman yesterday that is on one of those councils that they've now been monitored. They have somebody in there that's getting paid eye to type everything that's said. The first meeting they said was really good, and they felt like the officers could talk to them. But since then, there's been this like monitor person that comes in and sort of oversees, is typing everything. She says they can definitely feel the difference in how the police feel that they can be honest or true in those interactions,
yeah.
And how they feel, and also mm-hmm. how they are feeling. It was just interesting, right, that they've created these councils, that the intention, at least the said original intention, was to create that conversation between cops and community, but then it's been so highly monitored that the people, that the community that are there are actually saying they are fearful in those situations, and the police that are there, they're, at least from the community's point of view, are saying that they look like they can't feel free enough to talk from their, you know, hearts about what's going on or their own jobs.
Are there situations set up formally where, for example, young black men in their teens and 20s and cops can actually talk to each other as human beings? It seems like that's a big missing piece.
Yeah, well, so not that I know of as of right now. I do know there is the University of New Mexico and some community groups have a Men of Color initiative in which they have brought men of color together. I know there's like a black men's group that have brought some men together. And there has been some times that they've invited police officers from certain districts and they've been able to have those interactions. So it's starting. It's definitely in people's heads and minds. I think we'd be amiss too if we were in New Mexico to not really mention that Native Americans in particular, of course, Latino men and women face that kind of thing goes on with our communities. But that there's this, yes, there's this definite need for that. I think they're slowly starting, but how our officers are allowed to or given orders to interact with the police or interact with the community and with these groups that are really trying, right, to figure out how do we start these relationships, start what we know. Community policing is said all over the place, and I think if we asked 50 people, we'd probably have 49 different definitions about what community policing is. So, yes, I think those are on people's mind, but it's not happening in a systemic way or even a really resourced way.
Is there any kind of alliance among Black, Latino, and Native people here in New Mexico around these issues?
Yeah, I definitely feel so. Like I said, I mentioned the Men of Color Initiative and the Men of Color Alliance, and Strong Families is definitely a place where we bring folks from different backgrounds across racial, ethnic backgrounds, and talk about issues of police violence, state violence, talk about the policies and how we impact them.
Just addressing the struggle of Native Americans within New Mexico around the issues of homelessness and violence against the homeless. Shortly after the killing of James Matthew Boyd by APD, there was a horrific violent crime against a homeless Native American man. And certainly going back to the invisibility of violence against vulnerable communities, homeless members of tribes and that are living in Albuquerque have been invisible, and the violence against them perpetuated by the city of Albuquerque with laws that criminalize panhandling, for example, disproportionately impact the Native American community. So when we're talking about Albuquerque Forward, we need to be talking about that community and with that community, working with them to solve these problems.
APD Forward, like I said, we have a broad coalition, and Native American Voters Alliance is part of the coalition, Albuquerque Healthcare for the Homeless. There's a lot, El Centro de Igualdad, which works with immigrants. Those all the reason why we made sure those folks are at the table. And I know Native American Voters Alliance has done a whole like series of conversations in Native American communities about trying to capture what is people's interactions with the police and how do they feel about it and how can they make changes.
What are they actually saying? I mean, people who say, okay, this is what my interactions with the police are like.
I mean, overwhelmingly, people are feeling like they're negative interactions with the police, that they don't feel it. We had conversations with young people. We've had conversations specifically Native American communities, homeless communities, that they don't feel that they can call on the police for help. They don't feel that they can, if they are more trying to avoid the police than not. And they have a fear when there is a legitimate reason for them to call the police or domestic violence situation, working with domestic violence groups too that have been working with the police for decades now, trying to create a shift in the way they respond to that. That overwhelmingly people are worried, and even when they do take the step to call the police to get them out there, that they still have this anxiety around what's going to happen and what's going to be the next, and how can they do the steps forward. So it really is putting people in a traumatic situation without almost any place to turn. And of course they do, they are calling the police, but there's this overwhelming feeling of anxiousness around what does that mean, what's going to be the end result of this.
I mean, the problem is so bad that, I mean, before we went on the air, Shan, you were talking about how there are support groups for children orphaned by their family being killed by police.
Absolutely. I mean, the loss of consortium claims surrounding the police shootings in Albuquerque are heartbreaking. Representing children who are often under the age of 10 who wake up to discover that their parent, who they love, their father, has been gunned down by an APD officer. So this whole Norman Rockwell ideal of an officer, you know, as a role model for our children is shattered. And so there's a counseling support group for the children orphaned by City of Albuquerque shootings. And that was a big part of the Ellis case, was the jury valuing the loss of a parent. And it was a multi-million dollar verdict, because to take a parent from a child is devastating, devastating. And when you look at the suffering on the video of the officers who, after James Boyd is shot in the back, sick a dog on him and then shoot him with a beanbag and then walk up and handcuff him as his lungs are filling with blood and he's moaning, please, please don't hurt me. They are so dehumanized. Here's a human being suffering, and they can't render aid. In violation of their own SOP, which says if you use deadly force, the next move is to provide emergency medical care.
SOP, Standard Operating Procedure.
But that is the level of disconnect and dehumanization that's taken place among police officers. So to be afraid of those men is the appropriate response, because they are deadened. They do not respond to basic human suffering in a way that is related or connected to human compassion or empathy, or even doing their jobs.
We're talking about law enforcement, the Albuquerque police, what is to be done, and Emily Kaltenbach has been sitting here very quietly. And but we have a lot to talk about with you about a program called LEAD, L-E-A-D, which stands for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. There's a program in Seattle and now in Santa Fe. What's it all about?
So, you know, we've heard a lot sitting here this morning about the disconnect between law enforcement in our community and some of our community issues. And one of those issues, and we know this is an issue across our whole country, is that of this so-called war on drugs and the failed war on drugs. So as Shannon mentioned, this war on terror, there's also a war on drugs. And I think in the last couple weeks now, this country is slowly perhaps waking up and thinking about the growing crisis around mass incarceration in our country and the importance of reforming our criminal justice system and the issue of drug possession and drug arrests is very central to this conversation about reforming our criminal justice system and addressing mass incarceration. In 2013, 1.5 million people were arrested for drug crimes in our country, and 80% of those were for possession alone. And these people, in fact, are serving time in our jails and prisons, even though a lot of our public officials would say that they aren't. And imagine the toll this is taking on families and the resources within these systems. And so something has to change. And again, there's a huge issue around racial disparities that exist in relation to these drug arrests. And they are mostly young men of color, black and brown, who are ending up arrested and incarcerated for low-level nonviolent drug crimes in our country and here in our state, in our local communities. Even though drug use rates are equal, if not more, for the white population for those same drugs, but white men aren't ending up being impacted and sent through the criminal justice system like we're seeing young men of color. So in light of the racial disparities that exist in relationship to drug crimes in our country, local communities are going to need to find alternatives to addressing arresting people, nonviolent people, for small amounts of drugs that they're using for personal use. And in the city of Seattle, a little over 5 years ago, the Department of Justice, as Shannon mentioned earlier, came into their city and told them that they needed to address the disparities in arrests that were occurring in their city. And it forced a group of people to come together at a table that were really considered enemies of each other. So here were the civil rights community, ACLU, the public defenders, the prosecutors, law enforcement, and they were forced to sit in a room and they had to come up with a plan to address the disparities and arrests that were occurring in their city. And it was incredible what they came up with, and they came up with Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, the first community in our country to basically create a program that diverts people in that may be caught with small amounts of drugs for personal use or for subsistence dealing, and pre-arrest, pre-booking, diverts them into a social service program. Intensive case management, wraparound services, housing. This is a group of homeless people, primarily that they're dealing with, who lack housing, who lack access to food, to clothing, to job support and training. This was all a new approach to what we consider alternatives to incarceration or treatment instead of incarceration. It was redefining what we mean by treatment. And they started their program in 2010, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, and it's been incredibly successful. And here we are.
What does it look like? Let's give an example. Some cop finds a black or brown man who has a little bag of marijuana. What happens next?
So they would otherwise have arrested that man and sent them to jail, sent them through the criminal justice system. Instead, this individual is offered a choice to participate in the LEAD program, and that officer immediately takes that individual, and there is a handoff to a case manager. Instead of arresting them, handcuffing them, taking them to jail, they take them in a much more humane way to a case manager who sits down with that person, and they develop an individualized care plan. That case manager says, what do you need? And, you know, they need food. They need immediate housing. They're in crisis. And then that person is enrolled in a LEAD program indefinitely. And the beauty of the program is that it's really a harm reduction program. It's not an abstinence-based model where they say, if you use again, you're going to immediately be sent back to jail. Now, there isn't this stick hanging over their head. Instead, they're saying, you know, you're a person, you're struggling with an addiction, a health issue, and you should be treated as a person, and you should be treated in the healthcare system.
What if the person is not struggling with an addiction? They're just occasionally smoking marijuana.
That's a great question, and something that, you know, from Drug Policy Alliance's perspective, is a concern that we potentially could be sending people into a treatment system that don't exhibit an addiction.
I mean, they might be using marijuana the way the cop who arrested them is using beer.
Exactly. And so what happens there is they sit down with this person, and as I mentioned, there's an individualized care plan so that they say, what do you need? The person might say, I don't need anything. You know, and so if they never show up again, that's okay, as long as they don't show back up into the criminal justice system. So the idea is that this is reducing recidivism. And so if there's no problem to begin with, there's not going to be a problem 2 to 4 to 6 months down the road. They perhaps were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Perhaps they weren't smart about their use of marijuana, and they were caught for that. As we know, in Washington State, it's very different because now they have legalized marijuana, and so that addresses that question. But this program is really meant to identify the needs of that person and support them.
What are the sort of short and long-term economics of this program? I mean, it, I guess, costs money to hire case managers and so on, but I'm going to guess that in the long run, maybe it saves society money?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen study after study that shows that treatment instead of incarceration is cheaper than sending someone to jail. And we did a cost-benefit analysis here. We asked that same question. So Santa Fe became the second in the nation to implement the LEAD program. And prior to implementing, we worked with the Santa Fe Community Foundation and did a cost-benefit analysis. And what that indicated was that the criminal justice system, and so this is the cost of the police picking up someone, spending 3 hours bringing them to jail, booking them, doing the paperwork. Imagine this is taking this officer off the street for 3 hours to book someone for a tiny amount of drugs. And then that person is then living in the jail system for, you know, perhaps a night to 5 nights to 10 nights. And then the cost of the public defender that person then has been given, and the cost of the prosecution side, and you know, then there's all these other collateral consequences or costs that go on with that case. And so,
not to mention to the person, him or herself, who might lose their job or...
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Or then they're on probation, and if they are really struggling with an addiction, of course that person might use again, and then they're sent back to jail again and sit in jail waiting for their hearing because they violated probation. I mean, it is a cycle that needs to be broken. But back to the cost issue is that, you know, we found that over a 3-year period here in Santa Fe, and this is really conservative, is that that person was costing the system about $40,000 to $50,000 a year. Over that 3-year period.
Yeah.
In LEAD, or a LEAD-like program, that person would cost probably $10,000 to $15,000 less. So then you apply those costs over 100 people, we're talking a significant amount of money for our local community.
So how far along in this program are we?
So Santa Fe, we're a year in, and we have just shy of 40 participants. Santa Fe's program is focused just on opiates because, as we know in our community, we suffer from high rates of overdose deaths. Heroin and prescription opiate pills are one of the most concerning issues that Santa Fe and New Mexico face. So our law enforcement officers and our district attorney and our community providers in our city and our county decided that we would focus this program just solely on opiates at first and then see how it goes. So we're a year in, and anecdotally we're seeing a drop in recidivism by these individuals who are enrolled. Seattle just released their evaluation on recidivism, and it showed that of those people in the LEAD program, recidivism dropped significantly. In fact, they were 60% less likely to be reengaged in the criminal justice system if they were in LEAD than the non-LEAD cohort, or as they looked at. And they created a very specific study where they looked at a group that was non-LEAD and a LEAD-like program.
And so this is happening in Seattle. It's now happening here in Santa Fe. And as these models become more successful, in theory, other communities will adopt them?
Yeah, it's actually the LEAD model is getting a lot of attention nationally. President Obama included LEAD in his 21st century policing plan as a potential model to address some of the issues we heard about this morning. LEAD is a potential model to really be a reconciliation between law enforcement and the community. I have to say that pre-LEAD, we were skeptical of our work with law enforcement and district attorneys. In a sense, they were our arch enemy. They were the ones that were enforcing these archaic laws that weren't treating people like people, that weren't seeing that addiction was a health issue, not a criminal one. Having sat in the room with some of these officers in Santa Fe has really been eye-opening for me, and I know for some of the other civil rights groups and community-oriented groups. When we saw that these officers were struggling with what to do with these individuals because they knew that the jail wasn't the answer, and they saw these same people coming back onto the streets over and over again, cycling in and out of jail, they were the ones committing small, low-level property crimes because of their addiction. They didn't know what to do. And so they were really gracious and sat at the table with us and have been our biggest champions and are the ones that in the room will remind people that for some of these people, they're struggling with addiction and they are going to continue to use, and that's okay. That we need to support them. We need to support them and their families. And they'll be the first ones to start, we laugh because they're become the biggest harm reduction champions in the room, that we need to reduce
the
harm,
police.
The police, yeah. To themselves. They'll say, we need to reduce harm to these individuals and their families and the community. This is a public safety model. This is a public health model. And so I think there are going to be huge benefits to looking at replicating this model nationally. We just came back from the White House, who hosted co-hosted a convening on LEAD, where 30 different jurisdictions were in the room interested in the model. That's Baltimore, New York City, Houston, Denver, LA. I mean, big cities that are struggling with the same police brutality that we're facing here. And they see this as a way to reduce racial disparities in their community and to really reconcile the police and the community.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Shannon Kennedy is a civil rights attorney representing families of people killed by Albuquerque police. Adrienne Barboa is from Strong Families and the APD Forward Steering Committee. And Emily Kaltenbach is with the Drug Policy Alliance, working with law enforcement assisted diversion. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.